Welcome to the Silver Shield Report number 25. This is actually a last minute Silver Shield Report. I actually recorded another one with Marvin Motzenbacher, the gentleman that we did the Energy in the Next Paradigm, talking about different levels of preparation, some great ideas that we can look forward to in the next paradigm. But this issue has kind of turned into the third and final part of a trilogy. I did a video and an article. I did the article last year about the three coming false flags. I redid that on the YouTube channel, the three coming false flags. And basically in that little thesis, I laid out the major threat to our current world paradigm are the three threats to the Anglo-American Empire. You have the mathematical financial collapse of the dollar, which is an inevitable thing that is going to happen, and I've said this 100 times, I know you guys know this, but we're either going to have a point where our debt-based monetary system must increase the amount of debt in the system in excess of the debt and interest accrued the year before, or we have the mother of all margin calls, and as we know, in this highly leveraged debt-based system, we can't have that. We always err on the side of inflation. We always have whiffs of deflation like we saw in 2008. Very minor shock to the GDP. Yes, the stock market got rocked, but the central banks and governments were able to, flood trillions upon trillions of dollars. It started with the $800 billion that they got from the government, which got poured into the Wall Street system. That got levered up 10, 20, 30 times. The Federal Reserve loaned out $16 trillion. You can look that up on Bloomberg. And so that's a major threat. We have this inevitability. At some point, we're either going to default on this debt because the debt is too large and we can't even pay the interest on it, or the more likely situation that we will continue to print money, and it will result in the debasement and absolute destruction of the dollar as it loses its one of its primary purposes of a means of saving wealth. The second threat is the petrodollar. So it's part of the dollar situation. So we have the mathematical inevitability of the dollar collapsing, and it is supported by our world. If we were acting alone and the Federal Reserve printed up $16 trillion and the government spent $800 billion and it got loaned in and everything, we would have had massive inflation. But the point is, most of our inflation keeps getting dumped overseas because we have this petrodollar standard. And as I covered in Silver Shield Report number 23, Iran, Israel, and the petrodollar, we're coming to a point where this is coming to a head. So in order to stave off this mathematical inevitability, we have to go out and conquer other nations to force our dollars upon the world basically kick the can down the road. And so that's one issue. We have Iran, Israel, and the petrodollar that we covered in Silver Shield Report number 23. Silver Shield Report number 24, the next one after that, was about the next threat to the dollar, and that is the informational freedom movement inside the United States, where people are waking up and saying, hey, this doesn't resonate with me anymore. We're broke. Why are we overseas fighting all these wars? Why are we spending all this money? The Federal Reserve, they're privately owned, all this other stuff. So in the Silver Shield Report number 24, the last one I did, I got really pumped up because the last executive order that was passed just before St. Patrick's Day, it's like the final step that they need to formalize their tyranny here. I've told many people who, came to me with their concerns because they've always thought of me being kind of the level-headed Joe and, we're going to push through this and do it all right. In that report, I came off a little, excited, pissed off, or whatever. They talk about, the Department of Homeland Security bought 450 million rounds of bulletproof 40-round caliber, bullets. And I said, all that's fine and good. This executive order is fine and good. They can write all the laws that they want. The real crossing of the Rubicon is when you try to take the power system that has been evolved from us being the good guys in the world, us spreading our democracy, so that the people who work inside the system, that's what the propaganda is for, is those that work inside the system, that they can justify the actions that they do, in a very compartmentalized effort. So, you know, not everybody gets what the whole big picture is, but they know that they're supposed to do their own little part. And that this little mantra in their head, like, hey, we're the good guys, we're doing good things, you know, Muslims bad, Israel our best friend, Iran bad, China bad, you know, all these other things that they do, helps them justify what they're doing. But the time that the government, the power structure, has to turn itself on us, that's a huge difference. Because, first of all, the only time that they're really going to turn the screws on us is when we're really pissed off, which means there's already been a dollar event, which means that there probably already is another war. The reality of our lives is not going to match what the propaganda puppet masters say, the paradigm puppets. And then, you know, our society goes, hey, this isn't for us. I didn't sign up for this. And if the order ever comes down to, hey, you know, go into major metropolitan areas and it's a free fire zone, I don't know too many, you know, too many guys that are going to do that. Now, maybe they take some of the nutty psychopaths and put them off into one special unit. I definitely see that. There's definitely a test. I actually took a test in the Marine Corps. Would you fire upon civilians? And I'm pretty sure 99% of the guys in my unit didn't. But why ask that question? You know, do you think at some point they said, yeah, this guy said he would. Well, you know what? He might be up for a promotion next year. That's how psychopaths identify others and promote them inside the system that ultimately benefits them. So I talked about Silver Shield Report number 24, the final tyrannical push, as being that other threat. So between the financial threat of the dollar, the petrodollar, the informational threat of us waking up, the final threat and the reason why the Anglo-American Empire needs to create a false flag in order to create a war, which they have the most powerful military for and the most powerful propaganda system for, in order to upset the paradigm, is because the third threat, the anti-hegemon, which is another theory that I've put out there, is also moving against the dollar. So we have this mathematical inevitability, we have this informational awareness, and we have this whole other host of nations that are saying, hey, we don't benefit from the current world order. All three of those will never violently confront the current Anglo-American Empire, but at some point, if the Anglo-American Empire lets this go on too long, they're done. I mean, they're toast. You can't have a populace not participate in the paradigm and expect to have the government survive. You can't have other nations selling oil outside the dollar. That's why we went into Iraq. That's why we went into Libya. And that's why we're going after Iran, because it acts as an undercut towards the artificial support of the dollar. Internally, we have to use dollars to pay, not only because it's a legal tender law, but we have to pay taxes with it. And outside, you know, the world, because we're on this petrodollar standard since 1973, when we concocted this false oil shock with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia said, hey, we're only going to sell our oil for dollars, that created the petrodollar, and Saudi Arabia obviously reinvested it inside our markets, which washed it out, lowered our interest rates, and forced every other nation in the world to hold our dollars. But this anti-hegemon is an idea that I proposed for, and it's very different from just the BRIC nations. So I think it was Goldman Sachs that first said, hey, the BRIC nations, these are rising economic nations. And they're very similar to what the Asian Tigers were in the 90s. This was Brazil, Russia, India, and China. These growing economic nations formerly closed off, but now have embraced capitalism, and they were an economic challenge. Much like how the Asian Tigers, Taiwan, Malaysia, Korea, all these Asian countries were in the 90s. But I think the anti-hegemon theory is much more important. And as we go along, especially in this report, you'll see that it's not just the BRIC nations. This is something far bigger and much more of a challenge than just an economic competitor. This is a world multipolar challenge. And basically, the anti-hegemon is these non-aligned nations that do not benefit from the current Anglo-American petrodollar standard. And the question I have is, at what point in time will the emerging world have economic independence from the developed world? And I think this past week, we're starting to see this come into focus very clearly. So while the West scoffs at this idea of these nations becoming a serious threat because they don't have, quote-unquote, anything in common, other than that they don't like us, with both the IMF, World Bank, and with both the IMF and World Bank heads changing recently, the opportunity to appoint a non-U.S. or non-Eurocrat president was there, and they did what they always did. They put in another American at the head of the World Bank, and they put in another French nationalist at the head of the IMF after Dominique Strauss-Kahn popped out. And the developed nations are like, hey, you know, guys, we're big players here. We're not little boys anymore. This isn't 50 years ago. This isn't post-World War II. You know, we have half the world's population. We're growing the fastest. We have manufacturing. We have natural resources. And what do you guys have? You guys have, you know, glory stories from three generations ago. We want to say, and they have been. They've been at the UN saying, hey, we want more votes on the UN Security Council. India and Brazil for years have been trying to get into that five-nation UN Security Council, and they've been thwarted. They've said that they wanted more of a say at the IMF. They said, yeah, global currency, SDR is great, but we can't have the United States have, you know, this huge power over us when China is almost as big and yet only makes up like 1% of the, you know, the vote there. You know, and the same thing with the World Bank. You know, you have all these Kyoto protocols where, again, another Anglo-dominated institution saying, hey, you know, for the sake of, you know, global warming, we need to cut out all these carbon-based things. And China and India and all these growing nations are like, hey, that's how we run our government. We're not going to shut us down, you know, shut our economies down because you think that there's going to be global warming. So all these globalized, Anglo-American-dominated, Rothschild, Rockefeller institutions that are, you know, here to make all this peace, you know, all these BRICS nations are saying, hey, you know, you're not even letting us in, and you're still treating us like second-rate citizens, and we're bigger than that. So really, this one world order, this new world order, you know, that George Soros and all these guys are shooting for, is no different than what we currently have. They just want these other nations to bow and buy into and become dependent upon, you know, a further expansion of the IMF, a further expansion of GATT treaties and you know, all these treaties and World Banks and all that other stuff. So, and China has played along and said, yeah, we're interested. Yeah, we're not. But they've never fully bought into it, and that's always frustrated the Anglo-American empire. I mean, there's one interview with George Soros basically saying, you know, that they've been very keen on being nice to us, but they fully haven't bought into it because they haven't had a say. And, you know, these guys aren't going to buy into it unless they have equal footing, and the Anglo-Americans aren't going to give it up because they don't need to yet. So the U.S. has an exorbitant privilege of dollar hegemony, and it's coming to its end. Like, we already know that. The Anglo-Americans are like, you know, our future cannot lie with two separate systems, one with a Western, one with an Eastern system. The only way for a global economy to work is for global governance and global institutions, and the solution lies in reform of the existing system, not establishing a rival one. In order to understand this anti-hegemon, when I first proposed this probably about 2 or 3 years ago when I was putting together the Sons of Liberty Academy, I listed the core of this anti-hegemon being Russia, China, Iran, and Venezuela, as I believe that those four nations are probably the most powerful and most ardent supporters of ending the dollar. Like, they actually have the means to do that. There's another level below them that are either not as powerful or not fully on board, but are certainly in alliance with the core of the nations above. And in that category, I put India, Brazil, South Africa, and maybe even Pakistan, given all the troubles that we've been having with them lately, especially with the Osama bin Laden intervention and, you know, the choppers we shot down there. Pakistan's becoming a very powerful once ally and now has moved out. But beyond that, there are other nations, and I think this is where the future lies and where these nations end up going. And they're former enemies of the United States that have become institutionalized allies. But it wouldn't take much for a nationalist to say, hey, enough of this Anglo-American dominated empire. We have so much to gain from being free of it. And I would put nations like Japan, Korea, France, and Germany, you know, with the exception of France being former enemies, unless you want to go way back. Actually, I don't think we ever fought against France. You know, French and American Indian Wars and stuff like that. But France has been pretty much an ally in some respects, but they are certainly have been a economic challenge to the United States, especially during the Nixon closing the gold window. But Japan, Korea, France, Germany, all the former enemies who have been brought into our grasp over the years, and because we've influenced their institutions, you know, Japan probably being the most dominated of them, that we've created this whole subclass of yes men to the Anglo-American Empire. So while America was busy with Trayvon and Mega Millions, our world got very much smaller last week. And this past Wednesday and Thursday, these nations, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and now South Africa, so it's not just the BRIC nations, it's the BRICS nations, met in India. So let me give you a little background on it. These BRICS nations have five members. They now account for 18% of the world's GDP, 15% of the world's global trade, 40% of the world's global currency reserves, which is going to be very important later on in this show, and they account for nearly half of the world's population. Right off the bat, if they have half the world's population, almost half of the global reserve currency, and they're only making up 18% of the world's GDP and 15% of the global trade, it does not take too long to stretch your imagination that these nations could easily double their GDP and easily double their global trade if they establish some sort of economic system that they could thrive, much like how we've thrived. So if they get access to their own economies without the petrodollar around their neck, they're going to flourish. You know, just because you have half the currencies out there and half the population, not to mention, you know, the manufacturing base and the technology that they now have and the natural resources of other nations there, these BRICS nations could become very powerful, and they already are. I think I saw something saying that the United States GDP is like $15 trillion, Eurozone is now about $15 trillion, and that these five nations would account for close to $20 trillion. Making it the largest world market if they do what they're talking about in this meeting that they just had. But I find it very interesting that the BRICS are almost doing exactly what I want us to do. Okay, so much of the work that I'm doing on YouTube and on the articles is talking about walking away from the system. Don't fight against things. Don't try to influence other people. You know, in your own personal life, don't go to your mom and dad and shake their head and say, you got to sell everything and buy silver. Trust me, I did that. It doesn't work. People who are in denial, who are indoctrinated, who have a vested interest in the paradigm will never go against the paradigm. And it takes on you to walk away and say, hey, you know what? I'm cool. I did my best to try to wake you up, but I'm going to walk a path that resonates with me, that makes sense to me. And knowing what I know, I'm going to position myself in the best interest. This also has the same effect of the video I did, my one question to Ron Paul. Ron Paul worked within the paradigm for 30 years, had two very successful presidential candidates runs, did an awesome job of waking up the American population to the Federal Reserve, honest money, free market capitalism, the Constitution, non-intervention. I mean, so on and on and on, just a wonderful way of opening up the conversation. But in the video I did, my question was, you know, where do we go from here? He's not running for Congress again. He's done with this presidential election. He's certainly too old to run a third time in 2016. What could he do to really make a big influence? And for me, I would love for him to say, hey, I tried to work within the system. It's an impossibility. You cannot solve a problem with the same consciousness that created the problem. You must see the world anew. And that I think it would be more powerful for a former presidential candidate of his stature with such a following to say, hey, folks, get out of the dollar right now. Go buy some gold and silver. Go get stashed up. This thing is coming down. You need to become independent of the system. Don't bother voting anymore. It's a rigged game. Don't bother watching their TV anymore. It's a propagandized thing. Get out of jobs that you don't resonate with you. Don't work for people that you know that you don't have respect for. That could be sociopaths, psychopaths, whatever. Get out of personal, you know, all the same stuff that I'm talking about. Trying to do the exact opposite of the consciousness that we're consistently vying for, and become independent of and become powerful by yourself and walk away from relationships, jobs, financial, you know, obligations. You know, if you're sending money, if you hate Wall Street, why are you sending money there on a daily basis? You know, all these things, just walk away from, be the opposite power of. And it's only when you build upon your, and not only walking away from them, which takes power away from them, you're building yourself up as a power, and that's where real independence comes from. So I found a great quote. It said, and this is from, I'm going to screw up his name, a French philosopher. It said, all states, because they live parasitically off the population, on an ongoing basis, depend on eliciting the compliance of the people in some degree. No state can survive a mass refusal to obey. That's what we need to do. If you are against, you know, further putting your children into debt with these trillion-dollar deficits, if you're against war, if you're against fiat currency, if you're against propaganda, if you're against corporate institutions sucking all the wealth from local things, do the exact opposite on every level and do it purposely, do it, you know, every day. And it's only by then that we weaken the system that we're enabling. You know, it's not that the Rothschilds and Rockefellers have a magic wand over us that are forcing us to get into debt, vote for these puppets, you know, join their wars. It's we're doing it. And we realize if we're the ones creating the power, what if we focused on ourselves? So not only do I want us to do it on a personal level, which is what I'm doing here, I would like to see the Tea Party, Ron Paul, other people on a more, you know, national, global level to do that. But it's interesting, listening to some of the reviews of what the BRICS are doing, they're doing exactly what I'm telling you guys to do. Walk away, create your own paradigm. So listen to this clip.
The problem with vying for some kind of crumbs from the high table is that it still depends upon the mercy and the munificence of the former superpowers, who are now just great powers. The point is, in a multipolar world, I think it's better to launch your own initiatives and to show that you have the initiative to build your own institutions, rather than to beg for a few more voting shares and a few more places in the managerial or the boards of the Bretton Woods institutions. Because the Bretton Woods institutions, I don't think, can be reformed from within. They have failed, so therefore it's better to either abolish it or to replace it with a new institution. So this is where I think the BRICS Development Bank comes in. This summit here in Delhi, they have really shown that they have the capability to forge ahead with new plans, new ideas, and new institutions in order to govern the planet with a new ideology and a completely new functional basis for organizing economic life on the planet.
So did you hear him say, you know, instead of begging for crumbs and you know, waiting for the higher powers to bless us with a few extra voting rights and stuff like that, we're just going to go out and create our own thing. And this is showing the world is fed up with the current order. They're fed up with the IMF. They're fed up with the banks. They're fed up with the SWIFT system. They're fed up with the United States causing war all over the place. They're fed up. Because they don't want, this doesn't resonate with them. So all the same things that I'm telling you guys, I did this video that, you know, to march on Washington with all these Tea Party, you know, protests last year, the Veterans for Ron Paul march this year with Adam Kokesh, waste of time. begging at the feet of power does nothing. It's no different than a teenager slamming the door in his parents' house. It's not a threat. Never changes the dependent state. Never changes the controlling state. And it's only when a teenager gets out of the house, pays for their own bills, does their own jobs, has their ability to become an adult and be independent for themselves, that relationship changes. And what works on a very personal level in your life works on a national level, works on a global level. And that's exactly what these BRIC nations are doing. So one of the first things right out of the bat, and again, nothing was formalized there. This is basically a two-day press conference where they're going to say, hey, these are some of the things that we are working for and we're intellectually behind. As far as having the actual things working, it's not happened yet. So the first thing that they're talking about is the South-South Development Bank. And when I first looked into this, it seems like it's just a competing system to the IMF and World Bank. So instead of worrying about, you know, oh, do we get a couple votes? Can we have a president? You know, at the IMF and World Bank, they're saying, hey, we have half the world's population, 40% of the global currency reserves. We're growing countries, and we're friends with our neighbors. We don't drop bombs on them. We don't load them up with debt. So we're going to have an equivalent of the IMF and World Bank with the South-South Bank, and they can go all about and loan in all the denominations of these countries, make loans to help develop, nations around them. So if there's all these lesser nations like Uganda with their newfound oil and Joseph Kony and the reason why we're going in there, Libya and all this other stuff, that they can go to these other nations and say, hey, you don't need the IMF, you don't need the World Bank. By the way, just so you guys know, when the IMF and World Bank loans money out, it's really not giving it to the nations. It's giving it to the corporations that the contracts go to that the nations pay for. So, if there's a dam to be built in Uganda, let's say, the IMF says, hey, we can generate power for your growing economy. Here's $20 billion to go out and build this dam. Oh, by the way, you have to use our approved contractors, which, you know, are Kellogg Brown and Root, Halliburton, all these kind of Rand Corp, these big engineering firms, and they take this free money that they're given, and that they say, oh yeah, your energy production is going to pay it back, and load them up with debt. All the money goes back, and all they're left with is a construction project that went way over budget, has no means of really returning the wealth that was invested in it. And the World Bank and IMF come back in and say, hey, yeah, sorry that deal didn't work out, but we need you to pay or, give us some natural resources. And that's what they're always after. So this new BRICS South-South Bank, I don't know if they're going to do this with this new colonialism, but that's the kind of power that we've been pushing forward with, making these nations dependent upon, our dollar, put them into debt, make these projects that they have to use our corporations to pay for this. And I, in my heart, I don't think these BRICS nations are going to go about and make the same shitty deals with all these developing nations that they suffered under. Because when you look at it, four of the five members of the BRICS suffered tremendously under colonialism. Brazil under the Portuguese, India under the British, Chinese under the British, South Africa under the British. I don't believe that they're going to go out and say, hey, we finally got out from underneath this, these colonial powers, and then we're going to go out and do the exact same thing. I will get into why this isn't fully a opposite consciousness, because they are mirroring the exact same power structure that is a problem on this world. So not only are they using this bank to loan money to developing nations, which would allow them to create further and deeper ties around the world, and we're going to see how they're already doing that on a individual bilateral level, but if this group forms into something much bigger, watch out, folks. But they're also creating an intermember currency swaps. This is, I think, very powerful, considering the Forex market is gigantic. It is the largest market out there. I think something to the tune of $5 trillion a day is traded. And knowing that these guys have 40% of the world's global currencies, if they're able to create some sort of currency swap where they say China has excess capital in their banks and Russia needs to develop something, they can borrow against the Chinese currency to develop something in Russia without having to worry about, you know, currency swaps and, you know, all this, you know, international effort. If they set up these banks, this money will flow very easily and it will further develop. Like I said, they have half the world's population, 40% of the world's global currencies, and yet they're only 18% of the world's GDP. And that's because they don't have access to the capital markets that we do. And they still have this petrodollar, and I'm going to talk about how they're planning on getting rid of that too. But this is a very powerful step away from the Anglo-American Empire without instigating war. The beauty of walking away is that there is no violent action to cause a violent response. Problem, reaction, solution is at the core of our Anglo-American Empire. I did that video, Masters of War, talking about how we create problems, and that's the reason why I think at the end of the day we are going to have another false flag, because that's what we have done successfully, and why get away from it now? And I think it's also very important that South Africa was added to this BRIC nations. So what started off with Goldman Sachs saying, hey, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, growing nations, you know, going to be economic powerhouses, watch out for these guys. Now that this anti-hegemon is starting to muscle up, they're saying, hey, we would like some more influence in Africa. So South Africa is not that big of an economic powerhouse. They're probably the smallest of all of them, definitely the smallest of all of them by far. But I think they brought them on to have something on the African continent, because with Brazil and South America, South Africa being in Africa, obviously, and then India, China, and Russia taking up the grand chessboard. The only thing that's really missing is Australia, which China has recently signed a currency swap deal with them, and the Europe and the Middle East. And I'll get into that a little bit later on. But they're acting like very strategically, you know, placing these pieces on the chessboard and doing it with deals, doing it with diplomacy, doing it the right way, not, you know, loading them up with debt and then threatening them with bombs, which is what we've done. They're going about making deals. And I think that the real cagey thing or real smart thing that they're doing is that they're doing all of this development of a alternate Eastern-dominated paradigm while maintaining their position inside the current paradigm, the current world order, and benefiting off of that. So this effort of now creating the South-South Bank, watch how the IMF, the World Bank, the UN, all of a sudden, you know, say, hey, yeah, we'll let you have an extra Security Council seat. Yeah, we'll give you, you know, more say. We'll up the percentage. So these nations will be gaining power inside our paradigm because we need them. We're dependent upon them. And now that they're establishing their own independence, we want to make it almost too easy to leave. And I think that's what one of the things that you'll see is that the Anglo-American Empire will, you know, create some efforts to have them stay with us. But listening to the talk coming from this BRICS conference, these guys aren't interested. They'll play us, yeah, they'll play us along, but they're not interested. They see what they have now. They see that all the world has debt, dependence, and bombs. And the BRICS have markets, resources, and manufacturing, and diplomacy, and capital, and opportunity to grow. And they're not, you know, this warmongering nation that we're doing. So the BRICS leaders have accused rich countries of destabilizing the world economy over the past 5 years into this global financial crisis. They're mad. You know, the 2008 crisis, it hurt them, but, you know, they're saying, hey, we're doing everything right. We're manufacturing, living within our means. We have budget surpluses. We export. We're doing all the right things. Why are we suffering because you guys are, you know, have 0% interest rates and printing up all this money and causing havoc all over the financial world. We don't need this. So I think the moves that they're making with this this BRICS nation that's forming here is that they're paving a way towards another paradigm. And they're wide awake to this rigged game. They've been playing along. They've been playing in it, but they're walking away every much the same way that we should. Brazil said the problem does not lie with China and their currency. So we've heard, you know, everybody from Donald Trump to all these senators and saying that, oh, China's a currency manipulator and we need to put a 25% tariffs on China and we need to get them in line. Threat. And Brazil said, you know, the real currency manipulator is the dollar, is the euro. They're the biggest problem with money and money printing, 0% interest rates for I don't know how many years we've had it now, and exporting near inflation with the petrodollar. It's causing a monetary tsunami, and it's engaging in expansionistic policies such as low interest rates and bond buying programs. So, you know, the Federal Reserve is buying 61% of all the U.S. Treasury bonds out there because nobody else is buying it. So this BRICS nations are putting together, they're taking down trade barriers, and they're trying to create a waveless pool amongst themselves. That's what this South Bank is, this currency swaps, and a couple other things that I'm going to get into a little bit later, to buffer against the inflationary policies of the Anglo-American Empire as they move away from the dollar. I'll get into this. I don't think that they're going to be able to get away with it. Mainly because I think that we're going to have a false flag event before that that's going to trip off Iran and then China, Russia, and everybody's going to have to get involved, and we're going to have a huge war over this. Because their solution is not of the opposite consciousness, it's doomed to fail just like the dollar market's going to fail. Will it be, you know, the better of the two options? Yeah, I would say that these nations would fare far better because they have manufacturing, they have a population that works very hard, they have currency, they have access to oil, they have access to more friends, they have access to more people, and you know that I think they'll do relatively well, but they're not going to get away with a dollar collapse and not have them be seriously challenged. So as an example, Brazil just did their own deal with Mexico for a tariff-free trade outside of the World Trade Organization and GATT. So again, working outside of their paradigm, this controlled paradigm of the Anglo-American Empire, Brazil did a deal with Mexico to basically drop all the tariffs. And Mexico's, again, our partner, and it was wise for these BRICS nations to have Brazil to do that, much like I'm sure you're going to see a lot of South African deals with other African nations. So you have this economic bulwark onto this continent, and that these nations will go out and say, hey, we're friends with you, let's do trade. We don't need the dollar, we can use our own currencies. And they're showing by their actions. So, you know, by walking away and walking a different path and being a different way, they're showing that they don't need to create barriers. And we're not with the spirit, this is a quote, we're not with the spirit of trying to make things more difficult. But within the rules of the World Trade Organization, we're going to do everything we can to defend our markets. That's a Brazilian president that was speaking about this. And that's exactly what the Anglo-American Empire is all about, making things more difficult. You know, either on an institutional level or a war effort, it's all about making things difficult so that these other nations who are like, you know, we just want to do our own thing and be left alone. Another theme that I brought up, there's only two kinds of people in this world, those that want to be left alone and those that won't leave you alone. Well, our Anglo-American Empire is the nations that won't leave us and leave the world alone. That's why we're in all these wars. That's why we have all these military bases all over the world. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of impact this will have on the gold and silver market, because every banker in the world knows that in order to have a real successful paradigm, you have to have real backing. The only reason why the United States got this far is because after Roosevelt confiscated all the gold, there's 26,000 tons of gold in the United States. And after World War II, we had all the manufacturing and military power. So if the BRICS aren't going to challenge the United States and the Anglo-American Empire to military, they better have something else backing up this effort besides pretty ink and rhetoric. They are sorely weak in this area, and they don't have gold. I mean, relative to the amount of currency that they have, I think relative to the amount of currency China has like $3 trillion worth of currency, but only has like 1.8% of that in gold. The rest of it is in treasury bonds. Same thing with Russia, same thing with India. You know, that most of the wealth, the gold, is in the developed nations because they were these colonial powers. I mean, you look at, you know, Italy and Spain and UK and the United States, they're all, you know, benefited from some sort of, you know, exploitation somewhere along the line. So that's why I think that they're basically setting up a mere fiat system similar to what the United States has had. Maybe has a different consciousness, but at the end of the day, it's still a fiat system based off of, you know, debt. I mean, it's a debt-based currency system, and they still have the same fundamental problems that we have. And when the dollar collapses, I don't see how the, you know, the renminbi, the ruble, the all these other currencies are going to somehow levitate above it. Sure, they could, you know, become temporarily more powerful, but as the world economy stops and seizes, you know, their local economies are going to fall apart and the currencies are going to collapse. And that's why I think China is buying gold secretly and will probably not announce what they truly have until they're forced to or they're ready to step out in the spotlight, which would probably be years out. They are now the largest producer of gold and probably keep as much, probably keep all of it. That they're mining, since exporting gold in China is illegal. The other thing I think is very interesting is that China does not store its gold in the United States and UK like so many other nations, like Germany and Switzerland. They're, you know, Germany and Switzerland recently came out and said, hey, I think we have a problem having our gold stored at the Federal Reserve in New York City. We want to bring it home. And that, to me, is, you know, watch what these big nations are doing. So China has basically been establishing itself as an international gold hub. They just opened this new gold vault near the Hong Kong airport, which is, you know, not only in their financial capital, but it's also near an airport, which is pretty cool. It's supposed to be the most high-tech vault out there. It's supposed to be the best. So, but getting back to this idea that if we're in an era of currency counterparty risk, gold is the only currency that can trade even between enemies and have value. And that's where the real value is, that it is intrinsically valuable because it is rare. I do not think, as much as I'm a silver bug, that on this global scale, we're going to see silver have big moves from it, other than it might play into the strategic stockpiles if we do go into a war scenario. But certainly in the United States and as individuals who cannot afford gold, as these major nations keep buying it up, you know, we're definitely going to see silver rise. And I have to do another silver report soon, because I think just April is this breakout time, and we're going to see some really good action in silver soon. So all these currency swaps they're making the pool of dollars less in demand. So like I said, all these countries, in order to buy oil, their lifeblood of all their economies and everything that they built upon, they have to hold dollars. That's why China holds $3 trillion of our wealth. But this pool that needs this these dollars is becoming smaller. So, you know, probably about a year ago, Russia and China said, hey, we're dumping the dollar for bilateral trade. China and Japan 3 months ago or 2 months ago said that we're dumping the dollar for bilateral trade. We're going to use our own currencies. China and Australia recently announced that they're going to have some form of bilateral trade, not using the dollars. And if all these nations, and if these BRICS nations get this you know, bank together and this intercurrency swap things, where are all these dollars going to go? You know, they're not buying our debt anymore. The Fed is buying 61% of all the treasury debt out there. So all these dollars that these nations used to hold for, and if they're also buying oil from, you know, Syria and Iran and all these other nations, not with the dollar, you know, where are all these excess dollars going to go to? I'll tell you, it's going to go into our markets and mostly into commodities, because they're going to buy things to get rid of their dollars and buy real things. If you remember in 2008, China was buying 3 times market price for potash, which is a, you know, like a fertilizer from Canada. And we'll see huge moves in oil, because they can dump dollars and say, hey, yeah, we'll buy oil. But we're not going to be using this in the future. We're going to dump dollars and go buy gold. We're going to dump dollars and go buy silver. Fertilizer, food, corn, cloth, cotton, all these commodities. They could just dump these dollars, and they don't need them anymore because they'll develop this pool of inner agency, or this BRICS nations, where they can use their own currencies, and all of a sudden there's trillions of dollars out there that used to be held overseas that are going to flood home at the exact same time that we don't have anybody buying our debt, that we're still running trillion-dollar deficits, and we haven't even had a financial crisis or another war that they're going to have to pump more money in. This is where the hyperinflation comes from, folks. There just comes to a point where nations no longer want to hold the wealth. It's when individuals are going to no longer want to hold the wealth. And the only person buying this is the guys that are creating new money out of thin air, which is the Fed. And because of this, I think that's why we're going to kiss $3 gas goodbye and say hello $10 gas. With so many dollars floating around the world, inflation is not prices going up, it's the value of the dollar going down, and as more dollars find our way back into our economies or commodities that we're competing for, we're just going to be paying more and more and more for the basic necessities of life until the economy breaks, and then, it's a whole new paradigm. Ultimately, I don't think this BRICS nation bank is going to succeed because it is not truly of the opposite consciousness. I haven't heard anything about not having usury or having a commodity-based, bank, having, gold standard, silver standard, and oil standard, some sort of like currency that would, part of it backed by copper, part of it backed by electricity, part of it backed by timber, cotton, corn, currencies, a whole amalgamation of commodities and currencies. I think there was a proposal by John Maynard Keynes called the Bancor that was more of a commodity-based currency. But at the end of the day, it still seems like they're of the same paradigm of just creating, more debt and having a debt-based currency. And perhaps it might not be for them to survive the collapse, but to have something in place to create a structure to pull them out of the economic mess, quickly. There's nothing to say that a collapse needs to be generational or, like 100 years, like after the collapse of the Roman Empire. We will not forget, things that did work, and the nations that kind of get their act together will be the ones to recover the quickest. The ones that try to maintain the status quo through more tyranny are the ones that may never recover. So while we're looking at, as our group, states that are already putting forward, gold and silver legal tender laws and talking about states' rights and the Constitution, stuff like that, they're going to attract the best and brightest in the country. And I'm sure we'll be part of it. I'm happy to say that South Carolina, had a great report about the gold and silver market manipulation, that they're looking for creating legal tender laws down there, which is awesome. They didn't go so far as to say that the South Carolina government should invest in gold, but it's nice to see that they're actually talking about it. So perhaps this, BRICS nation, this meeting that they're having, is really just to set up the structure for a post-dollar world and saying, hey, the day the dollar dies, yeah, we're going to, take it on the chin, but here's our plan to get out of it quite quickly, because we're still going to have half the world's population, and the manufacturing and all the resources and all these cool relationships that we're forming now, we'll get our countries going back up much quicker than the Anglo-American Empire, that's probably going to turn inwardly and try to protect what they have. So the BRICS want to create this basket currency that would rival the dollar, the euro, and the IMF SDR, saying that, hey, we don't need the dollar, the euro, or your SDR. We don't need to be a small portion of your global standard. We'll just create our own, and they can do it. And that's the beautiful part of walking away and becoming independent. So here's another huge agreement that came out of this, is besides more formal currency swaps, they're going to set forth a path to investing in each other's equities. So without currency risk, they're going to cross-list indexes on all their exchanges. So You know, if you want to invest in China oil, their oil companies, you can do that in India, Russia, well, China, obviously, Brazil, and South Africa on their local stock exchanges. And then if you want to invest in South African, gold production or whatever, they'll have indexes that will be listed on all five exchanges at the same time. And you won't have to worry about currency swaps because it'll all be traded in the local currency. That is huge because that's leading to more integration. That's leading to more economic development. You know, if there's, China's got all these trillions of dollars sitting over there, it's difficult for them to invest in South Africa without, you know, having some Chinese diplomat go over there and talk to a South African diplomat to go meet with the local, you know, industrialist to go, you know, do all this other stuff. If they open up their markets, people can directly invest in each other's companies and say, hey, I believe in South African gold production. I believe in China oil. I believe in Russian gas companies. I believe in, Brazil with whatever they're producing. They can do that immediately. And the ability, again, for them having 40% of the world's global currencies, half the world's population, but only 18% of the GDP, you're going to watch that explode. I mean, they're going to literally blow up with the amount of development because they're going to have more capital flowing around the world. So not only are these BRICS nations doing this within themselves, they're going out there and making friends. I already talked about the Brazil deal with Mexico. They're not in the BRICS, but they're part. You know, they're reaching out. China with Australia has a small deal. How about this one? China and Saudi Arabia have put together the largest deal for a refinery to be built in the Red Sea port of Yanbu'l by 2014. So Sinopec signed a deal with Saudi Aramco, which is the state. So these are basically two state oil companies, Saudi Arabia's and China's, signed a deal for a major oil refinery to become operational on the Red Sea port of Yanbu'l by 2014. It's an $8.5 billion venture, which covers 5.2 million square meters and is already under construction. It will process almost a half a billion barrels of heavy crude per day, and Aramco will own a 62.5% stake of the plant, and Sinopec will own 37.5%. So back when the United States and Saudi Arabia agreed on this petrodollar, all the oil sold by Saudi Arabia would be denominated in the dollar. Well, this petrodollar system was adapted almost by the entire world because it had great benefits, and it had great benefits to the United States. But what if China becomes Saudi Arabia's most important trading partner? Then why would Saudi Arabia continue to sell only in U.S. dollars? And if the petrodollar system collapses, what does that mean for the United States economy? We're 25% of the world's oil importing 5% of the world's population importing 25% of the world's oil. That allows us to have the world's largest military that consumes most of this oil. Most people don't realize how much the military blows through with military. I mean, you get these jets that are, you know, they talk about us buying more efficient cars, but these jets are blowing through gallons of gas per second, and, you know, they're blowing through all that. I tell you what it means. It means that we're not going to live the life that we're used to, and it's going to be a tremendous shock for the American economy. And while China is going to suffer, they haven't flown as high as us, and I don't think they're going to be as affected, especially if they have buddies, partners with Iran, you know, Saudi Arabia, and all these other things. You know, they're able to do deals with this. So while we have intellectual or political reasons why we don't do business with Iran, China's like, hey, yeah, we'll do business with Iran, Syria, Joseph Kony, Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, we're cool. You know, all we want is money and to do deals. If it's in both of our best interests, what do we care? So I think the most important thing that came out of this, besides the bank, besides the currency swaps, besides the stock deals, besides all these, reaching out and creating all these deals, the most important thing that came out of this meeting was the rhetoric on Syria and Iran. Okay. So let me start with, President Assad sent, a letter to the BRICS, nations, or BRICS leaders. It's tough saying that, talking about how, he's so happy that there's a group out there essentially that respects the sovereignty and independence of states, that multilateral international action is an alternative to the policies of hegemony. Notice that word, the anti-hegemon, the hegemony of the United States. He didn't say that. And the interference of other states in internal affairs. And he's looking forward to more cooperation in building a multipolar world that values democratic relations among states. So President Assad said that Syria is inflamed due to misleading media campaigns and continued assassination and terrorist operations backed by forces who are provided weapons and financial support to extremists and tried to use international forums of issuing decisions that are not consistent with the United States UN Charter and shouldering the Syrian government responsible for what's going on. And Assad saying, hey, we got terrorists here with armed gunmen, and they're blowing, kidnapping, destroying infrastructure, basically running amok. And it's clear, based off of all the history that we've seen, the Anglo-American Empire is behind this. This is exactly what they did in Libya. And Putin already talked in this letter that I read. Putin's already called Gaddafi's assassination beyond medieval and called it primeval. And that he said, he clearly stated that Assad in Syria is not going to suffer that same fate. So we already saw rumors of Russian troops in Syria. I had heard that one of their battleships got docked there. And they announced that they wanted a ceasefire. And they don't want the UN to give cover to regime change and unilateral actions by, you guessed it, the Anglo-American Empire. And this was made evident by two vetoes by the Russian and Chinese diplomats against Syrian restrictions. On the heels of that, China and Russia just now announced a new naval war exercise in the Sea of Japan. And this is all on top of pressures mounting for Brazil and India to get UN Security Council seats. So, you know, here's Brazil and India, you know, the sixth and seventh largest economies in the world, saying, hey, we want a seat at the table. And with this BRICS action, they're going to get more power amongst themselves. And this is using power for them to say, hey, you know, give us a seat. And you know what? The Anglo-Americans may want to buy some time and give them a seat. Or maybe just walk away from the table. You know, you don't know. But I tell you what, man, there's a lot of big forces that are emerging here. And I'm so glad to have the time and energy to be able to keep my eye on this, because this is going to affect everybody. Another action that happened recently, Syria exported some, was trying to export some oil, and because of these restrictions that are currently going on, they couldn't find an insurance company, they couldn't find a tanker, and they couldn't find a way of clearing the money. So initially, Syria reached out to Venezuela and said, hey, can you find a shipping company for us? But ultimately, Iran came in and said, hey, we'll ship it. China bought all the oil from Syria and insured it, which is a very important part because, you know, you can't have, you know, a couple $100 million worth of oil floating around the sea and not have it insured. And because the West has put all these economic sanctions on these two countries because they're against the petrodollar standard, it's huge for China to set up and say, hey, yeah, we'll not only buy it, we're going to insure it, and Iran shipping it. This is pretty big. So this ship is coming, will arrive this Wednesday in Syria, and then it's going to make its trip to China. So what does China get out of this? Well, first of all, they get a discount on oil. So, you know, with the understanding the petrodollar, the higher the price of oil goes, it actually benefits the United States because the world needs more dollars, and they'll work harder for it. And since we print it out of thin air, we can make these dollars appear. And, you know, again, it's just we're trading our debt for real commodities and forcing the other world to sacrifice everything real to get more of our debt to go buy this commodity. But China basically came out and said, hey, Syria, we'll buy your oil. We're not going to pay the world rate of, you know, I don't even know what it is, $110 a barrel now. We're going to probably pay you $90 a barrel. And we're going to buy it, insure it, and Iran's going to ship it. But the overt action of China to do this is, I think, astounding. Usually China is the one that's, you know, doesn't vote, you know, doesn't come out against this, doesn't really go against the current trend. And here's China muscling up and saying, hey, this is our oil. We want it. We want price of it. We're not going to listen to you guys. You guys have your own issues. We want it to do this ourselves. So this is a direct response to the SWIFT system, that Belgian bank, intergovernmental, interbank financial system being shut down last week. And what's going to end up happening is this sounds like it was a rush deal, but I guarantee you with this BRICS meeting, you're going to see a more formal system arise that's going to challenge not only the IMF and the World Bank and the dollar, but also the SWIFT system. And I think the reason why China step up is because you don't mess with a nation's energy supply. To me, that's an act of war. I mean, that's what got Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor. And you also don't mess with the nation's currency, and that's what the SWIFT system thing is. Again, take yourself out of this American paradigm. If the world shut us off or shut our ability to get money into our country and shut off our oil, what would we do? We'd be bombing at the first dawn. Well, that's what we're doing. When we shut off Iran from the financial system, it's an act of war on Iran and Syria. And as a result, oil is getting stopped to India and China and the rest of these Asian nations there. And that's an act of war unto them. And who does it benefit? It benefits us. We're trying to provoke these guys. And they've been wise not to take the bait. But, you know, destabilizing currency systems like we did with this, when we said that we're not going to have the SWIFT system go there. The Iranian rial went through, I think, a 50 or 60% depreciation over 3 months, ruining their economy there because of that. And messing with the nation's currency. We went through that with Britain more than a couple times. The British flooded our American economy with fake bills to destabilize us. So you could see this during the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and even the Greenback. Where the British counterfeited our money, spent it into our economy, destroyed our currency, made us weaker. So the BRICS very forcefully came out and said only diplomacy is a viable option with Iran. They also recognize the right for Iran to pursue peaceful nuclear power. So they're coming out and saying, hey, no war in Iran. We're not going to stand for it, which is something that they didn't do with Libya, that they didn't do with Iraq, but they are doing with Syria and Iran. And they're saying the formal reason why the war drums are being beaten for this nuclear power is that they're cool with it, and that's not an excuse to create a war. But we all know this is about the petrodollar, so they're playing coy, saying yeah, peaceful nuclear power. But we know at the end of the day, you guys are all concerned about your petrodollar. So right now with this meeting, you got these BRICS nations coming together. And they're talking about creating their own SWIFT system. They didn't formally come out and say, you know, this is the anti-SWIFT system, but that's where this is going to go. Because it was a weapon against Iran, and to the full extent that this appears to have been ignored, China and India are Iran's two largest clients. I think they import 50% of all of Iran's oil. And they found that the United States can hurt them considerably by cutting off Iran, and hence the oil. So if they can hurt them this way, they could probably hurt them the same way on other issues. So the real question is, why are these BRIC nations now asking, why must we be subject to the financial will of the United States? And that's why this meeting is coming about, and that's why this is such a huge issue. And to think that we've been spending so much time on Trayvon and the mega millions while this is going on, it makes me want to rip my hair out. It's just so important. So the question has been these long-term implications that could affect these nations' freedom of financial activity. The questions demand to see just how powerful the United States really is. Is it a paper tiger? And it's clear that the emerging nations, if they're going to keep growing unfettered by the United States, they must set up a system that is not vulnerable to the United States' influence and to reduce the influence of the United States dollar itself. China has been very careful moving away from the dollar because it has $3.1 trillion in reserves, and it wants to maintain it. So this is a great way of walking away, keeping inside the system, and creating your own powerhouse, so much so that you can walk away. So, you know, think of it on a personal level. You have a job you don't like. The boss sucks. He's, you know, sexually harassing you. He's making you work overtime. You know, just a total paradigm that doesn't resonate with you. You don't like it. It's not beneficial to you, and you want to get away. So what do? You, on your own time, start creating your own job that resonates with you, your own skill, your own hobby, your own trade, something that provides real value, and you work on that while you still say, yeah, boy, yeah, yes, boss, I'll work, yeah, whatever you want. Meanwhile, at home, you're like, mother, I'm going to bust my butt and create something that's independent of him. And hopefully that business becomes viable so that you can just say, you know what, I quit. And that could be what China's going to do, but quitting a dollar paradigm is going to be very difficult. And it's not something they can do right now. Because I tell you what, if the dollar plummeted today, $3.1 trillion of reserves, and they don't have gold, it's going to be very difficult for China. So they're trying to do this peacefully, systemically, multilaterally, very large way of doing this as an evolution instead of a kill switch. So I got to ask you, look at where we are today. Do you think China, with their deals with China and Russia, have removed interdollar trade just like they have with China and Japan drop the dollar? They're now doing war games between China and Russia. China is rushing trade agreements with Brazil. Brazil's doing trade with Mexico. China, Russia, Brazil, India, and South Africa are now moving to trade more in their own currencies and not the dollar. Saudi Arabia is moving to formalize trade with China and Russia. And Singapore is moving just to trade in the yuan. So all these things that are going on there, it doesn't look good for us, folks. And this is all before the next crisis where, you know, the Federal Reserve and .gov even have to pump even more money into the pool. And if the world ends up rejecting the dollar and we end up rejecting the dollar, all that's left is the lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve, and the spender of last resort, the government. And that's it, folks. That's it for the dollar. At some point, the psychological event of no one trusting the dollar, no one wanting the dollar, and that people will only want real currencies or currencies backed by nations that they have intellectual, you know, that they resonate with on a bigger level, they're not going to want the dollar. And, you know, at that point, that's when I think that this this thing's going to get bad. And knowing all this stuff and knowing that we have these warmongers in power with this Anglo-American empire that have, you know, basically dominated the world over this past century through debt and death, you know, they're not going to just go quietly away. And that's why I think this three false flag, you know, theory has some merit. And whether it ends up, you know, working out the way it does or not, it's definitely something I'm looking forward. So I hope you enjoyed this. It's probably one of my shorter Silver Shield reports, but I feel like this issue is so important. It kind of wraps up the last two Silver Shield reports. Next week, we're going to do the Marvin Motzenbacher interview. I had some really cool ideas on this next paradigm. I have an announcement with the our first meeting, hopefully at the end of this month, and a lot more cool stuff. So, and also the dollar trial thing. This actually turned out be pretty cool. I don't think I'm going to do it all that often, but we ended up with, I think, 55 people actually signing up for it. And out of the 55, I think we ended up with 42 that have stayed on. There's still, you know, another couple days for people who signed up late. But still, I think an overall good effort, because I think the majority of the people that joined for the dollar really had no intention. There was one guy who says, too broke to joke, was his email. So, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of people there who really had no intention of ever joining, and that they were just going to take the free ride and you know, go for there. But nothing but positive results from the people who did. A lot of young kids, you know, talked about, you know, one day that they'll be able to come on board, but they're, you know, they just don't have the cash to do that. I did give out probably about six free memberships from the people that dropped and said that they really did like it. So I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know, it's a pretty cool experience, and it's one that, you know, certainly helping me, you know, get insurance. We're probably about 2 weeks away once we get our taxes done to get health insurance. We haven't had that in over a year and a half, and we're obviously looking to start to have another child. And that's, a definite, because I had, one friend who had, twins that had, one of them had almost $1 million worth of bills because he was a preemie. And then our other friend, their one son had a a cyst on the neck, and they had to do emergency C-section and all this other stuff. So having a child and no insurance is not an option for us. So we're getting there. So that we're moving along. So it was. I hope everybody enjoyed this, and we'll get back to you next week. Thanks.